Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the UK-Rwanda migration agreement. I'm joined by a very special guest, David Suba. David is a researcher and freelance journalist working on intersection between organized crime, people smuggling, and border policing. David is currently finishing his PhD at the UCL Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science on the impact of border enforcement on the adaptation of people smuggling. David, I'm very delighted to have you join me today. I know we've been, you know, looking to this episode in the last couple of weeks. I'm finally, finally have you here. I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Michael. It's very good to be here.
Brilliant. So let's just start off for those that don't know what this UK-Rwanda bill is. Can you provide an overview of what it is? What is the objective of the agreement? You know, how did it come about?
So the UK-Rwanda deal was made a couple of years ago, really, by the now former government, the Tory government in the UK. And it ultimately was a way for the government to suggest a new way to deal with irregular migration to the UK. So it's very much a deal that was conceptualized and thought by the UK government, the last UK government, Conservative government, to create, in their words, deterrence against irregular migration to the UK. So their idea was that if they implemented this partnership with Rwanda, and through the Illegal Migration Act that was voted then in 2022, every person that was arriving irregularly, crossing the channel from France to England or to the UK, was then going to be transferred to Rwanda for their asylum application to be processed there. Now, the thing that not everybody understood, apart from like the specialists and the lawyers at the beginning, was that if people were going to be then transferred to Rwanda, their whole asylum application was going to be processed by Rwanda, which meant that if their asylum application was successful, they would not be transferred back to the UK. They would stay in Rwanda and be protected under Rwandan legislation and essentially be hosted by Rwanda for the foreseeable then future. And if their applications were to be rejected, then it was also upon Rwanda's responsibility to return those people to their home countries. So essentially, the UK with this agreement was aiming to offshore it's part of its asylum application procedure to Rwanda, deeming that Rwanda is a safe country and has the legal, humanitarian, logistical capability of taking this on.
But in the last 2 years that we've had this, there's obviously been it's been very controversial. Mm-hmm. So I know in the UK, for instance, you went through different processes in the courts where they had issue with human rights. And what are these controversies surrounding? Why was it controversial? What are the controversial
aspect? Well, the controversy around it was that the UK found that the UK courts, you know, some appeals were put together, especially after I can't exactly remember the dates now at the top of my head, but at some point in 2022, the government started, you know, tried to actually implement the first departure flights. And these were blocked by you know, lawyers representing those people that had been identified from different nationalities, from Syria to Iraq to Vietnam, as the first kind of group of people to be sent to Rwanda under this this agreement, and their defendants' lawyers kind of blocked then these you know, these flights from taking off. Hmm. Initially, actually, the flights were blocked on like some legal arguments specifically related to the particular circumstances of how the legal procedure of identifying these people had been done in the UK. But ultimately, mm-hmm. then the biggest legal challenge was moved against the idea that that Rwanda was to be deemed considered as a safe third country, based that somehow the definition of how Rwanda was to be considered safe was whether it was going to be able to maintain the same level and the same guarantees of protection to the refugees and asylum seekers that were going to be sent there as the same kind of standard to the UK. And the lawyers and the courts basically outlined that this was not going to be the case, especially referring to the risk that people transferred to Rwanda would then be at risk of refoulement. So of being then sent, you know, either of not being guaranteed the asylum seeking, you know, the refugee rights that they would otherwise be recognized in the UK, or to be returned to their home countries, and this breaching their rights. And so this is what the courts ultimately sentenced, which was against the judgment of the government at the time.
And I know there was a lot of tinkering with the law, you know, with the Tory government, and in terms of seeing how to either adjust to satisfy, and eventually kind of like satisfied the courts, and they give the green light. But if you look at it within the broader UK migration law, and look at the international refugee law, mm-hmm. how do you think that law fits in within, because a lot of international human rights have looked at that goes against the UK, which is signed to the international refugee law or whatever treaty, that it goes against that treaty. How, in what specific way does it go against that treaty?
So you know, the this is a little bit where the crux of the argument is, because the government, the UK government at the time, you know, we're speaking now a few days after the election of a new government. So you have to distinguish also, because the new government that came in a few days ago, you know, just announced that they're actually going to scrap and not go ahead with, you know, not take on the policy that was voted by the previous government. So actually, at the moment, as we're speaking today, the UK-Rwanda deal is over. I think that the previous government was arguing exactly that. It was arguing that they were not going against international law, that they were not in breach of the conventions on refugee rights, because by considering Rwanda as a safe third country, they were basically saying Rwanda is as safe as the UK. So a person that is applying for asylum in the UK, we are just, you know, because of our internal political situation, making this agreement with Rwanda for this person to go and seek safety in Rwanda, where we will guarantee, we as the UK, the government, the Tory government at the time, will guarantee that they will have exactly the same type of safety that we would otherwise offer refugees in the UK. And the courts basically were disagreeing with that, based on previous examples and previous experiences of refugees, you know, being sent to Rwanda from other countries, namely Israel, that had an agreement with Rwanda between 2013 and 2018, where a number of asylum seekers from Eritrea and Sudan were transferred from Israel to Rwanda in that period of time. and the experience of these people. The fact that it was found out under various investigations in the years that followed that many of these people that had been transferred to Rwanda in that period of time actually had not been able to find the safety guarantees that the Israeli state at the time was promising. And actually what had happened to many of them was that after arriving in Rwanda, their migration journey had started again. And many of them had then tried to reach Europe through other ways again. And so the inefficiency of that agreement posed, I think, the legal challenges to the agreement that the UK tried to make with Rwanda a few years later.
You said quite a number of things. I'm going to come back later to the new Labour stance on the Rwanda's agreement. But let's just talk about the migration itself. In the last 9 years now, from the 2015, when it looks like we had a European migration crisis, migration has been defined as a crisis. And I've had previous episodes where a lot of people disagree with that connotation, that do we really do have a crisis? Thus, is there a legitimate crisis in the UK for migration? Or is this a political, because it's become like a political issue where different parties, when it comes to election, use this, to bolster the party or to be able to ramp up their base. So do you, from your experience, and also as a border police and migration expert, do you think there's a migration crisis? Or do you think this is, just being politicized?
I think it's an interesting question. I think a little bit of both, in the sense that a crisis is often difficult to judge on some objective factors. No, so I think that there is definitely a perception crisis in the UK as well as in other countries in Europe that migration. The perception that migration is somehow a problem, if you want, in inverted commas, or something that needs, to be resolved, something that needs to be tackled, something that is putting, that it's posing some serious challenges to societies in Europe, is definitely a crisis when it comes to the perception. Now, I would argue even further that somehow there is a difference between the perception at how it is created, for example, by the media, and the perception that, at how it is actually then perceived by voters or by communities in these countries. I would argue that the biggest crisis of perception that there is, especially in the UK, is a crisis in the media. In the sense that if you look at some polls about how are different issues in the landscape of British politics and British media represented, then migration tops very often some of those statistics. But if you look then at instead polls about how high does migration rank on the population perception of what are the most important challenges for British society, it is not always the case that migration, is there at the top. There are other elements that British public is mostly concerned or worried about. And then when we talk instead about the real crisis, the crisis that is experienced then in the administrative system, in the political systems, in the real lives of asylum seekers and refugees and undocumented people in the UK, there is a crisis in the sense that the whole system of asylum and recognizing people and allowing them to access their rights is somehow blocked, it's clogged. And so people that are arriving to the UK and applying for asylum have to wait an incredible amount of time before their asylum application is processed. This is related to political choices that have been made, none for least, the UK-Rwanda deal that put many people's application on hold because they were deemed, cases of people that might have then made those, put on those planes to go to Rwanda. So the fact that there are, nearly 50,000 asylum seekers' applications that are not yet being processed in the UK means that there are 50,000 people that don't have access to work, don't have access to, you know, starting rebuilding a life in the UK. And in this sense, yes, this is a crisis, because then, you know, people need to be housed. And the government is spending money on, you know, the so-called hotels, or, you know, the actual hotels where people, many of them are then being hosted. And at the same time, I mean, I think that the biggest problem of all is that people are not allowed to work. So ultimately they become a cost and not a resource for the state. Not to count also on the mental health and, you know, the fatigue of people being in this limbo, just waiting for a decision to happen and not having any clear understanding of that of when their asylum claim will be processed. So in that sense, then the crisis becomes very lived, very real. Like the crisis, there is a crisis that is reflected by the experience of people. But I don't think that that is a crisis necessarily experienced by the British public. I think that that is a crisis experienced by the asylum seekers that are in the UK waiting for those decisions to be made.
Very interesting. But is it not an irony? If we look at in the UK, for instance, where if we look at Labour, not Labour Party now, look at Labour in terms of like in certain sectors where there's labour shortage, because we've seen different certain sectors in the social care sectors, in teaching sectors, where the UK have then made other kind of bilateral agreements to get people from other countries to come. So there's definitely shortage, labour shortage. And do you not see that as an irony? Where a lot of these people that are coming could then bolster the economy of the UK government or the UK economy, and how, like you rightly said, this has been politicized, and who suffers is just the asylum seekers, and then they look like they're the pawn. So I wanted to speak on that, and also speak on usually when we. Where the point of blame, usually talk about the people smugglers. There's always, you know, who is to blame for this is the people that are trafficking. Who are these people? Because we kind of like conflate all of the people in that small boat to be people that have been smuggled. But it looks like a lot of people have different motivations for traveling. How do you be able to filter this and provide a nuance in analysis of that aspect of it?
Well, so there are two things in the question that you've asked. No, the first is this aspect of you know, the irony that somehow there is a crisis, perceived or real, in the British context, when there is also a shortage of work and of workers, so a higher demand of work and a shortage of workers, and then the whole. You know, a crisis at the border in relation to the smuggling gangs, the so-called smuggling gangs. So I will reply to these separately. But you know, in regards to the first, I think that tells you very much about how this issue can be so easily instrumentalized. So at the same time, when you know, post Brexit, the UK has faced labor shortages. The government, the former government, doubled down on this rhetoric of we need to get refugees and people that have no right to stay in this country out. While at the same time, you're right, seeking then for agreements with other countries for specific workers to be able to come to the UK and work in specific sectors such as healthcare, agriculture, you know, the sectors where their services. You know, all this issue about having not having enough people to drive trucks to, you know, take goods around the country is a big issue. And definitely there is an irony there. I don't think it's an irony. I think it's a very manufactured situation by which in order to maintain the threat, you know, a very xenophobic threat of like an enemy, you know, and knowing that at least in general in this historical time, refugees and migrants pose such a very easy kind of you know, constructed threat to the imagination of European societies. The government at the time needed to have this enemy, whilst also silently needing to find a solution to the problem of not having enough workers in the country, without then making, you know, the simple kind of connection of like, all right, there are people that are actually really high skilled, want to arrive to the country, they have, they can, they want to give a contribution to the UK society, and also, you know, for bettering their own lives. Not to mention the fact, I was listening to some of the podcasts that you've made in the past with other speakers. I can't remember exactly who was mentioning this, but it's a very important fact that, you know, there is a whole element of like the economy of remittances that migration in general contributes to, especially when we're talking about Africa. The remittances that African workers working abroad contribute to their societies in Africa. It's, I think your speaker was talking about twice or thrice the amount of international aid. Or international funding that is then sent abroad. You know, so that is ultimately African workers contributing to the making of their own economies by being by making the sacrifice also of migrating outside and then supporting their families and communities abroad. So it's, you know, it's something that should be not only celebrated but kind of we would need more of that.
I agree.
And then to the second point that you were talking about in relation to the smugglers, I think that that is also another clear example of scapegoating, of needing, you know, the bad guy somewhere in the story to again find an oversimplified solution to a more complex issue. And therefore, you know, the narrative of we need to smash the gangs or stop the boats. Now, you know, the new government, the narrative is shifting from stop the boats to smash the gangs. I you know, from the research that I do, I don't particularly see how that is going to be conducive to a long-term resolution or, you know, of for example, the irregular migration across the channel. Because as you were mentioning, often the people smugglers or the organizers of these journeys are actually nearly every time they are not the ones that are getting on the boats, so piloting the boats to the shores of the UK, and the people that are getting arrested are just are asylum seekers that you know have had a specific arrangement. Maybe they're paying less for the crossing. Oftentimes it's people just passing the tiller to each other, so multiple people on the boat are taking on the responsibility of driving the boat. But then, you know, in the way that border enforcement works, they might take a photograph from a drone of a specific person and then identify that person, and that person becomes the only culprit of that crime.
Very interesting. Now, we've mentioned two things. You mentioned money in one instance, and we'll mention the new labor. Let's talk about the costs and how, again, we're still talking within the paradox of, do we really want to solve this issue? What is is it cost effective to divvy it in this other way that we're talking about, or is this cost efficient the way? So it's cost about, is it $300 million? I don't know how much pounds that is cost so far. So is that gone down the drain now without a single person being transported? How does that?
Are you talking about the UK Rwanda deal here?
Yes.
Yeah. I think I have similar figures. I think I was reading this morning, £300 million. Yes, that is money that is gone down the drain. You know, the UK government has already, the previous government has already paid those. Probably actually that is an underestimate of the figures, because there are also the figures that the government incurred in, for example, sending British officers to Kigali to prepare these agreements, you know, their stays. And but I think that the bulk, I had the figure somewhere, I think the bulk of that money was 270 millions that were paid into Rwanda's Economic Transformation and Integration Fund, which is ultimately an economic fund that the Rwandan government will be managing, or was supposed to be managing, in order to include and reintroduce the asylum seekers that the UK would have been sending into the Rwandan labor market. So it was, you know, a fund basically aimed at creating jobs and job opportunities for people, for the asylum seekers arriving from the UK. I think that from what I've read, there have only been 5 people that were sent on a voluntary basis to Rwanda. So Maybe those five people have won the lottery because they will have a lot of funds to be supported from. But yeah, you know, that actually tells you something, which is the issue that there is a debate, especially happening in the courts, on whether Rwanda should be considered safe or not. But ultimately, Rwanda is a country that is doing very well comparatively to other countries in the region from an economic and development point of view, but is also a country that is struggling with its own issues and poverty and a labor market is one of those. So I think that Rwanda had all in its interest to be able to say, right, we are going to take migrants and asylum seekers from the UK if the UK then supports their integration into the Rwandan labor market. And so ultimately, I think that is money that the UK has spent in Rwanda and that the Rwandan government will be able to now probably use for something else. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, if we look at the new party now, which has only been there for a couple of days now, and one of the immediate action they've taken is to say, you know, this deal is dead. You didn't talk about their kind of like new thinking about where they might want to go. Do you see what alternative they might present?
I think this deal is probably dead when it comes to the UK. And it will be for a while, just because the new government that was elected a few days ago has put so much political capital behind the ineffectiveness of this deal. So Keir Starmer and Labour has campaigned very actively that they would scrap the Rwanda deal. Were they to be winning the elections? They won the elections, and the first thing that Starmer said was, "Okay, the UK-Rwanda deal is over." Mm-hmm. So I think that in terms of the agreement of this type of agreement between the UK and Rwanda, probably we will not see this, resurfacing up in this way. I would be surprised if it did. But I think that the idea behind this deal is absolutely not over. It's absolutely not going to be scrapped, and maybe it's not going to be reproposed by the UK, but other European countries are definitely thinking about very similar arrangements. So the idea that is behind the UK the UK Rwanda deal is the idea of safe third country, that European countries are now, starting to talk about more and more, especially in Europe after the recent European elections, when actually instead there was a surge, for example, of right wing, political parties. By which, everyone in Europe was looking at the UK-Rwanda deal, especially on the right and in the center. Hoping that this deal would go on to work and then being able to point this as a success story in order to say, okay, this is a way we're going to solve, our migration crisis in Europe, is going to be finding safe third countries elsewhere in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, and offshore our asylum seekers over there. Because ultimately what, the experience of the last 20 years has taught, European countries is that sending back people to their country of origin once they arrive to Italy or Greece or Germany or England is not very easy. Because you need to have bilateral agreements with those countries and have those countries been, happy to take people back. And there are two reasons why. Those agreements are very unviable. The first is because these type of agreements are very unpopular in those countries of origin. Because many of these countries, you know, are either facing conflict or climate degradation or economic circumstances that then push a certain group of those countries to try and migrate elsewhere. And if those countries are then accepting, you know, those
more
people,
like,
there is a resentment coming from society. There is a pushback coming from society. And the other one is that, again, a lot of these countries instead are countries where there is an active conflict. Most of the people that are arriving to the UK today are coming from countries that are in an active conflict. So they are absolutely in their right to seek asylum because they are in fear of their lives and persecution in those countries. And so no government would be able to kind of create a return agreement with governments such as, I don't know, the government of the Syrian regime or the Taliban in Afghanistan at this point in stage.
Very interesting. In Africa, I'm thinking the episode you must have listened to. We've talked about the myth of migration and say like 80% of migration, we focus on Africa, is within the continent.
Yeah.
Rather than outside of the continent itself. Well, do you agree with that assessment?
Totally. I totally agree with that. I think the sentence after of your guest at the time was, borders in many regions of Africa are colonially defined. You know, they were drawn and got created during the colonial period, and communities in those countries don't recognize those borders. So, you know, those borders have often divided in Africa, like as in other places in the world that were deeply affected by European colonialism and settler colonialism, by they divided communities. Communities that were, you know, that saw themselves and perceived themselves and lived as one before. So those, you know, in Africa, I'm not an expert, but what I know is that I would definitely agree with that there is a lot of regional migration. And that regional migration is really beneficial, actually, for you know, cultural and economic development in the region. And ultimately, somehow, I think that part of the policy that the European Union, especially in these days, is trying to push on the African continent, is one that actually curtails that regional migration as well. Because a lot of the agreements that are being made today on the concept of externalization of European borders, and in the last few months we've had a lot, you know, we've had European Union making externalization and border control agreements with Tunisia, with Mauritania, with Egypt,
with Morocco,
exactly, and even further than that, you know, with Niger, with Sudan before the conflict erupted, with Ghana. Those are ultimately agreements by which the European Union is saying, right, we are going to deliver here cooperation in order to kind of restrict those borders as well. So that's why, you know, the term that is often used in the scholarship or by journalists is this externalization of the European border. So pushing the European border, you know, on the African continent to securitize even those borders that, you know, are far away from Europe.
I think I've used those terms as well in my research, where inadvertently or maybe deliberately, you're extending your borders. You're extending beyond your own borders. You're setting up border posts. You're dealing with stuff in and you're infringing somehow on the sovereignty of these countries as well, because they have to give, you know, you have to process these papers, you know, maybe have your officers, you know, stationed there. That's like you're pushing your borders towards this. But again, in a final, we've seen where you might not be an expert in it. Before I come to the last question, you said, you know, clearly maybe not on the African border, but we've seen also the African Union in terms of like the role they're playing with the African Development Agreement that they had 2018, to see how they can, you know, create an integrated African country where, you know, there'll be less border, people can, you know, people, whatever, can travel. in these places. I don't know how far that is going, but I was gonna say one of the things that I've been raising the African context is that many of the people that have been sent to the Rwanda stuff are not even, most of them are not even African, of African descent. How do you, what's your view about that?
Absolutely. I think I also read, when I was doing a bit more in-depth research before the agreement was, when the agreement looked like it was going to be going ahead, that mm-hmm. Rwanda had made a specific kind of clause or had wanted a specific kind of clause in the agreement with the UK mm-hmm. that mentioned that the people that were going to be sent to Rwanda could not be from the DRC, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or from Burundi, mm-hmm. or from Tanzania, mm-hmm. or from Kenya. So from the countries surrounding Rwanda. So somehow the agreement was specifically for, you know, Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans, mm-hmm. you know, people that have very, very little connections to Rwanda. And that ultimately, I think, was... and maybe with this type of critique, I agree. One of the reasons why this agreement between Rwanda and the UK, in the UK context, I would like to specify, was seen as quite unethical or inhuman. It was often described because ultimately sending someone, you know, arguing, well, if you are looking for asylum and you're running away from a war, let's say in Syria or in Afghanistan, and you're looking for safety, you don't have the privilege of choosing where you can go and be safe. You cannot choose, I want to be safe in the UK. We will choose for you. You can be safe in Rwanda. But ultimately, we
can
know
you that... Can you give me a minute? Just give me a minute. Just see if you...
I was just mentioning, you know, the fact that it's... people kind of like try and reach countries where they know that they will have a community to join often, because being a foreigner in a country where there is nobody from your own community is really hard. So sending asylum seekers from countries, from non-African countries or countries that are really very far from Rwanda, knowing that there is none of that communities in Rwanda already established and present, is going to make it incredibly challenging for anyone that is sent there to, you know, be able to rebuild a life. And that is, I think, a big concern that many of those that challenged the UK-Rwanda deal in the UK had.
So let's bring this to a wrap. So I asked two questions to conclude this episode. So number one is going to be from the UK Rwanda perspective, and the other one is going to be from a general perspective. So from the UK Rwanda perspective, how do you see moving forward? What do you see moving forward? If you're going to predict or look at what do you see going on? What can you advise? If you're like, let's say you're the UK advice or the Rwanda advice, what would you advise? How do you see it going forward? And then from a general perspective and based on your own experience, researching and writing on this subject, what do you think would be the lasting durable solution?
I wish I had that answer. okay, let me tell you something. From the Rwandan perspective, I think that they went into this agreement knowing very well that it was going to be that there was going to be a backlash. I don't think that they expected the agreement not to go forward, but I think that they considered very much their interest into this and put on the plate, you know, what they knew that they could deliver. And I would like to mention something else, because, you know, Rwanda is already a location of international migration cooperation on a global scale, because the UNHCR, so the UN Agency for Refugees, has an agreement with Rwanda to transfer to Rwanda asylum seekers and migrants that are presently in Libya in very, very vulnerable situation and conditions. The UNHCR, after identifying people in Libya that really need to get out of Libya, has an agreement with Rwanda to transfer these people to Rwanda, where they are sent, where they are hosted in a temporary reception center before their applications are considered by other countries in the world and another resettlement, a permanent resettlement is made to countries like Canada or other countries. So Rwanda, in that sense, is already a partner on somehow, you know, playing its role into the global management of migration, very much under the, you know, under the oversight and the collaboration with the United Nations. And this is a program that has been happening until since 2017. It's something that the United Nations were managing also with Niger. Now, after the situation escalating in Niger, that program has been be put on hold and is probably going to be closed. But Rwanda is as a country is committed to keeping that going. So in that sense, Rwanda was saying we are a safe country for people because we are already doing it. Now, the difference is that that was being done on a temporary basis. It's something else to then commit to hosting people for forever. And that was a commitment that that Rwanda was ready to do, and that hasn't yet happened. As I mentioned before in another question, I think that this is not the end, you know, that the Rwanda-UK deal is over, but it's not going to be over for this idea of establishing this type of deals further. I know that other countries in Europe are speaking very much also with Rwanda to reproduce similar agreements. And then in terms of, you know, more general solutions, this is really, it's complicated to say. I think that ultimately what is being become very clear to me and other colleagues that focus on international migration and the securitization of migration is that restricting movement doesn't make movement disappear. It only criminalizes it. It only makes it more vulnerable. It only puts the lives of people that need or want to move at risk. And that I think we are already, and we are going further into the direction of it's big terminology, but global apartheid, by which certain people from certain countries are more and more able to travel where they want. Other people from the majority of countries instead are being restricted by very restrictive visa regulations, and their only way of moving outside, whether for humanitarian reasons, for political reasons, for business reasons, for economic needs, is to do that irregularly, and therefore relying on all those provision of irregular services such as smugglers that thrive in a context of irregularity and criminalization. So I think that the direction that unfortunately I see as an international community going forward is probably still going in that direction. We still haven't come up with the awareness that something else needs to happen. And probably that would be probably something that, the African Union is rightly arguing about, promoting more fluid and easy regional movement that I would say would need to be advocated also on a global level.
Very interesting. I'm thrilled by what you've said. It's you've captured, and the concept itself, the global appetite, is, I've not heard that. I'm just hearing that now. I've learned from this conversation. It's been a very interesting conversation, David. I'm glad that you joined us today, and we're really very grateful for your very, very useful insights. And thank you once again for joining me, David. And we'll keep you posted, and hopefully one of these days we call you back again and we'll see.
always available. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'll keep in touch.
Fantastic.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in today to a very special episode on the UK Rwanda migration agreement. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I did, and I implore you to join me again next week for another exciting episode. Until then, stay blessed.